If the court please, my name is Nathan Nyman, together with co-counsel David Newman, and we represent Kimberly Hansen.
How much time would you like for rebuttal?
7 and 3.
Okay.
There are a lot of issues that are presented in this appeal. And there are a lot of errors that we have assigned to the conduct of the trial court. But what I want to do is I want to focus on an issue, a linchpin issue. We believe that if we get the right decision on the linchpin issue, almost all of the other issues will completely fall into line. And so today, given the time limitation that I have, I want to focus on that limitation, on the linchpin issue, unless you take me other directions. The linchpin issue is this. Is this really a will contest? It's such a simple question, but the way you answer that question, almost everything, the summary judgment standard, the burden of proof, whether there is a TEDRA application, a special motion for summary judgment, all of those things flow from that. I want to unpack that issue as succinctly as I can in the time that I have. If transactional documents... We believe that there are testamentary documents, and we believe that there are transactional documents, and the law makes that distinction. And there are different standards as to how capacity is decided under both circumstances. If transactional documents make an immediate, irrevocable transfer, in general, that's called a gift. It's made right on the spot. It's irrevocable. It's immediate. And if the gift is made at the same time the will is signed, on the same table where the will is signed, and you have a will and you have a stack of transactional documents, 24 documents, about 119 pages being processed in about 30 minutes. But there is a will. There's no denying that a will is executed. The 4 months passes on the will, but the transactional documents are still transactional documents. They aren't testamentary. When you get your notice in the mail that says you have 4 months to challenge a will, you may not even know about these transactional documents at all. The key to this case is that Mark Rosgay, the primary defendant, obtained immediate, irrevocable grants distinct from the will. The will was not challenged. The 4 months passed. After the 4 months passed, then and only then, did all of the donative intent transactional documents begin to come to life.
If we accept your proposition that the transactional documents are not part of the will, how does that change the way we look at the capacity of the grantor?
The way the change occurs is the transactional documentation. Let's do it like this. Mr. Rosgay wants the lower testamentary standard, and it is a lower standard. It's, I know who I am, I know what I've got, I know the bounties of my affection. A low-level, low-threshold test. Here's how it changes it, Your Honor. The law cited in our brief says the transactional documents, forming an LLC, signing a purchase and sale agreement, requires much more than knowing who I am, what I have, and who I love and want to bless. And there's a huge reason for that, because first, a testamentary transaction standing alone can be rather simplistic. And we all know in our careers about deathbed wills and people who can say, I know my children are Sally, Fred, and Linda, and I know I have 40 acres and here's what I want to do with them. It's quite a bit different when you take a person that you present an LLC, a purchase and sale agreement for the sale of their stock, the conversion of separate property into community property, you sign six consecutive assignments of membership units, you make an immediate irrevocable transfer. And maybe, Your Honor, the better answer to your question as I reflect on it, because I want to answer this question squarely. Testamentary transfer has a lower standard because it is ambulatory, it can be changed, it can be revoked, there can be second thoughts. If I irrevocably deed my business, my house, to you immediately, and the deed is signed and the bill of sale is granted, and as the Verbeek case says, I didn't do Latin very well, it creates an in presente, a present interest. You've got to show the donative intent. The whole concept shifts. I will agree with Mark Rosgay that if you challenge your will, and there's a fundamental right to leave your property as you see fit, and the case authority is well briefed, if you go ahead and you make a will, it's judged by testamentary capacity. If you make a gift, the donee, everything shifts. It's a different burden of proof, a different standard, and a different summary, or a different standard on summary judgment.
Good morning. My name is Scott Ellerby. I'm here on behalf of the respondents. And may it please the court, I'm going to address first the last point that Mr. Nyman just articulated, and that is whether the transactional or contract capacity test in practice is really any different than the capacity test to support testamentary capacity. And I think we covered it in our brief that in application, there's really no difference. The transactional capacity test is not a higher standard or higher burden. Transactional capacity relies upon the ability of the contracting person to comprehend the nature of the transaction, the terms, and the effect. And if you compare that to testamentary capacity, it's really no different. The testamentary capacity refers to the particular kind of document, a will or an ancillary estate planning document, and that's effectively the same as the contract transactional capacity test. So here, we satisfy both tests. I'd like to quickly switch gears to the standard of review and this issue about whether or not this case is a will contest or not. I think it would be artificial in the extreme to allow a party to challenge ancillary documents that are part and parcel of an integrated estate plan. Documents such as trusts, LLC agreements, LLC operating agreements.
But none of those agreements are dependent upon the will.
The trusts are because the wills are poor.
The living trust has
that's correct.
A pour-over residual.
That's correct.
But not for the irrevocable trust, not for the LLC. Those aren't dependent on the will.
Well, they're dependent on the will in that they wouldn't be entered into irrespective of the will. They all are part and parcel of a very complex, intentional estate plan crafted by a specialist in high net worth individual estate planning. None of these documents would have been executed on their own. They all work together. And so if you pull one of the sticks out of this structure, the whole structure collapses, and that would defeat the intent of these testators who wanted to pass their estate to some of their children with the least tax implication involved.
And so if I have an estate plan where it calls for a deed of property to a family partnership, all as part of a overlaying estate plan, and then a year later everybody gets together and says, you know, that's a bad idea. Let's undo this thing. We're going to undo this. Isn't that the dividing line between what's a true testamentary device subject to the four-month statute versus something else that might be part of a plan, but it in fact has impact today?
Yeah. Well, I think that would be a different situation if, you know, the parties want to revisit one of the documents, but that didn't happen here. I mean, these documents were all intended to work together, and they did. Barbara Roske passed away, and these documents went into effect. Some of them went into effect immediately, but they would not have entered into those transactions but for an integrated comprehensive estate plan.
What case says that's how we look at that?
Well, there are a number of cases. Washington law has applied the will contest standard of proof, where the contestant has to prove to the trial court that it's highly probable that they will prevail at trial in presenting a clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. The Kitsap Bank versus Denley case applied that standard to a bank account beneficiary designation. The estate of Thornton case, a 2015 Division II case, applied that standard to a trust that was executed in combination with a will. And the contestant there was claiming constructive trust to attack the trust provisions. We've got the World Gospel Mission case that also applied that higher evidentiary burden to trusts that were executed in combination with pour-over wills. And the court held that if you allow this contestant to challenge the trust, they have to meet the requirements of a will challenge. Otherwise, it would lead to a result that would defeat the intent of both the testator and also the intent of the Washington legislature in instituting this very restrictive time bar, the four-month bar, as well as decades of case law that have erected significant burdens on will contestants, designed to promote the efficient administration of estates and to make it difficult to challenge estate plans.
But in that case, that's Palmer.
Palmer, right.
The trust wasn't funded. They were pour over wills there that directly funded the trust, correct?
I believe that's correct. Okay. That's right. Yes.
I want to jump ahead for a second. I want to talk a little bit about undue influence. Here, wouldn't you agree that if we view the evidence in the light most favorable to Ms. Hansen, that all three of the elements to show undue influence are present?
No, I don't agree with that. I vociferously disagree.
I mean, there's certainly a confidentiary or fiduciary relationship.
We agree with that element.
Okay. And he did participate. He was there at the opening meetings. He was there at the final meetings.
That's not sufficient under Washington law to just be there.
But isn't that a question of fact?
It would be a question of fact if there were more of a participation, but the participation under Washington law requires not just presence, it requires active inserting of oneself into the discussion of the substance of the estate plan. The lawyer who crafted the estate plan testified that Mark Rosgay vociferously objected to participating in any of the discussion. He said, leave me out of it. So you need active participation. And then the third element is also missing, Your Honor, and that is the receipt of an unusually or unnaturally large part of the plaintiff's estate. Here, Mark Rosgay and his brother were children. And if you're a child, no Washington case has held that if you get a share of the estate, that that's unnatural. It can't be.
Well, he's got a significantly larger share than his sister.
He did, but the parents had already disinherited the oldest sister. So they showed themselves to be quite capable of making that type of judgment independent of any kind of influence from anyone. The fact that they did it again with respect to this plaintiff, Kimberly Hansen, shows that they were just being consistent and there was no influence on them. So I don't think that the presumption of undue influence applies here, but even if it did, there was more than enough evidence submitted at summary judgment to rebut any presumption of undue influence.
But again, why isn't that forcing the trial court to weigh the evidence to make that determination?
Your Honor, I think that the trial judge, under the standard articulated in Kitsap Bank versus Denley, for instance, and having to find that the plaintiff will be able to show that they have, it's highly probable that they will be able to prevail at trial, I think that by its very nature requires some degree of balancing, and that's what this trial judge did in finding that the evidence was overwhelmingly against the plaintiff's claims here, given her earlier articulation of her antipathy towards her parents. The other point I wanted to emphasize in my brief seconds remaining is that, even if we did not have, if you treat these ancillary documents as non-testamentary documents, Washington law would still require the application of a clear, cogent, and convincing standard of proof. That was required as far back as 1957 in the Binder versus Binder case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The third component of the Dean case goes to a consideration of whether there's an unnaturally large bounty. But the Dean case is a case about wills. The Dean case is not a case about testamentary documents. In this case, here's what happened. There's not a pour-over trust like there was in the World Vision case. There was an immediate conveyance of a golf course home on Medina into an irrevocable trust. There was an immediate transfer of a Hood River or Hood Canal home where the parents weren't even the beneficiaries. So, sure, if you just want to look at the probate assets, you can say, okay, good enough, point made. So the Dean case, that doesn't, and it says list other components. Other components? Can a man who lives in a house for 40 years and can't find his bathroom create an LLC and sell stock? Can a man who mows the asphalt road in front of his house and thinks he's in a backyard and has people bring him back to get him out of the road, can a woman who does physical therapy exercises for years and years, can't remember how to do them without looking at him, who needs help paying her bills?
But here we've got we do have his attending physician testifying that did have his capacity.
Yep, absolutely. And on summary judgment, sure. He says they understood the significance of the documents. That doesn't mean they understood the documents. It meant they understood the significance of the documents. Now let's break this down. I'll do what's dangerous in one minute and so. Here it is. In White versus White, this is the difference. The rationale for distinguishing a gift during one's lifetime from a challenge to a disposition on one's death has been enunciated in this jurisdiction by making a gift during a person's lifetime, he strips himself of that which he can still enjoy and which he may have need of during his life, while by his will, he deposes of that which can be of no further use to him. He is under ordinary conditions so much less likely to do the first, the gift, than the second. The courts subject the gifts to sharper scrutiny. I beg you, read the complaint. There is no will contest. The transactional documents were contested. The burden of proof went completely backwards, and the standard of summary judgment was not based on absence of material fact. Remand and vacation of attorney fee orders, if you would, please. Thank you.
Thank you.